Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After listening, be sure to join our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to connect with the community and discuss the episode. Follow us and enable notifications on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform so you don't miss new episodes. You can also find all episodes and information on this subtype or your subtype on SFA's website, curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. On this episode of Sarcoma Stories, we're joined by actor Andrei Ivchenko as he shares his powerful journey through a chondrosarcoma diagnosis. While you may not be familiar with Andrei's sarcoma story, you might recognize him as the villain Grigori in Stranger Things Season 3 or as Perseus in Call of Duty. After being initially misdiagnosed, Andrei's story highlights the critical importance of self-advocacy. In this candid and engaging conversation, we discuss the isolation that can come with a rare cancer diagnosis like sarcoma, the vital role of a care partner, the importance of ongoing research, and how prosthetics are used in sarcoma treatment. Following an extensive hemipelvectomy and hip replacement, Andrei is now in recovery, gaining strength to return to the screen and using his platform to raise awareness and advocate for the sarcoma community. Thank you so much, Andrei, for joining us and sharing your story. Let's listen in. Welcome to Sarcoma Stories and welcome back if you are a regular listener. My name is Tasha. I'm one of your hosts.
Hi, and I'm Brandy. I'm your other host.
And today we are joined with Andrei Ivchenko. Andrei is here joining us to talk about his sarcoma story. You might be familiar already. Andrei is most well known as the villain Grigori in Season 3 of Stranger Things. And perhaps you may also know him as Perseus from the popular video game Call of Duty. We are so thrilled to have you here today, Andrei, to share your story. And I was thinking before this podcast, at the time of my sarcoma diagnosis, Stranger Things Season 3 was one of the shows I was watching during my chemo treatments with my little sister, which is wild. Would you like to tell us a little bit about how your sarcoma story started?
Yes. In 2024, I started to feel a little pain in my right hip. So I went to the clinic and the doctor did the x-ray right there in the clinic, and after he said, you have a little inflammation around your hip joint, and I'll send you to the physiotherapist for about 10 or 12 sessions. I went to physiotherapist, and somewhere in the middle, I started to understand that it doesn't work. That is probably not what that doctor saw on the x-ray, something more complex. And I have a background in a physical education, so I can understand anatomy and how it works and bones and muscles. So I was going with all this treatment and talking to physiotherapist, more I started to question the way we were going or the way the doctor interpreted that x-ray. So anyways, after the 12 sessions, nothing happened, nothing changed. Basically, the pain was progressing and I didn't see any ease after this treatment. So I went back to the clinic. The doctor left or got transferred and they put me with another doctor who was specializing on it. So that doctor, I described him what the previous doctor suggested, and he sent me to do MRI. So I did MRI, and I believe 3-4 days after that, he called me. So when he called, I thought something's going on. He said, I just got the results, and I decided to call you right away, and there is something's going on with the tissues there, but it's more complex that is out of my expertise. He literally said, I can't understand what's going on there. I will send you to the specialist, to the surgeon who basically specialized on that kind of situations. So he sent me to the surgeon. He looked at the MRI. He said, something's going on there with the bone tissue. It's not just inflammation around the joint. There is something going on with the bones. So he sent me to do CT scan and another MRI again. When I came back to see him, he said there is a suspicion that it might be cancerous development. But he said we need more research and we need look deeper into it to fully understand what's going on there. So he didn't give up and he was keep digging, did biopsy. Biopsy came back a negative, but he didn't stop. So he did some other tests. Then I came back to see him. He said, it looks like it's cancerous, but it didn't spread. So maybe we will monitor that for about 3 months before we make conclusion and we see which way it goes. And then from that point on, we will decide what to do. It was like the first time when he said it might be cancer, I obviously that news that it's a cancer, it's a shock. And I've never had any member of my family which I know of had cancer. So for me, it was a shock, not only because it's cancer, but because like, where is this cancer coming from? You know, and I was healthy through all my life. So that was like a double shock. But when he said, we're going to monitor, we don't really know what's going on. So maybe it's not a cancerous tissue. It was like a bit relief. But then he called me probably a week after that, and he said, I need to see you.
Mm.
So that was unexpected. I went to his office, and he said he basically gathered all the cancer specialists and doctors.
Like a tumor board.
Yeah. And they discuss, particularly my case, based on the studies, chondrosarcoma studies that had been done before. And so when I saw him that time in the office, he said, we're going to go forward with the surgery. Because I talked to the doctors and we decided that 3 months is going to be too long and that cancer can progress during those 3 months. We decided we'll go through the surgery. And that means half of my pelvis will be removed and in my hip joint and replaced with titanium prosthetic.
And was that the first time you had heard about that surgery? That's a pretty big surgery to go through. Was this the first time he talked about the surgery? No.
Yes, it was the first time. He mentioned the surgery prior, but it wasn't directed to me. It wasn't like, I'm going to go through this.
Yeah.
It was like, just it could happen. Yeah, somewhere over there, it was a possibility. Mm-hmm. But now we're talking about me going through all this gruesome surgery. I knew people who did hip replacement and knee replacement, but it was like after the month, they could walk with the physiotherapy, they bounce back fast, and it was totally fine. But this was completely different scenario. We're talking about half of my pelvis removed, replaced, and put on the screws, and on top of it, hip replacement. So it was another shock, even bigger shock than I had before. But I trusted him, and I didn't see any other. And he told me as well, there is no other option. Because he told me that this cancer is very rare. The cancer is not studied enough to know the reason and place it's coming from. And there is no other option because this chondrosarcoma doesn't respond to chemotherapy. So it has to be, the only option here is cut the diseased bone out and replace it with a titanium part.
Yeah. And so when they were introducing the surgery to you and explaining this is the only way with your diagnosis, When was the first time they told you this is a chondrosarcoma? Because that first biopsy came back negative. So when did they figure out not only is this cancer, this is a chondrosarcoma?
Yeah, actually about biopsy, I didn't mention, he sent me to do first biopsy. And they did like a regular, they put the needle through the thigh. When the result came back, he said he didn't get what he wanted to get. So he said, I will do it myself.
Wow.
So the second biopsy was really very invasive. He drilled my hip on the side, through the side, not through the front.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so it was pretty brutal, I would say. I've never went through that kind of test.
Yeah.
It was so brutal that after that, I have to walk 6 weeks on the walker without putting any weight on the right leg.
And this is before your surgery.
Oh, it's before my surgery. Yeah. So after the second biopsy he did himself, he got the result, and that's when this real thing came out.
When did they were going to monitor it? Was this before the second biopsy that they were just going to monitor for 3 months?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
It was before the second biopsy. And I think it was before even first biopsy. That was the very first conclusion he made based on CT scans and MRIs. But then, obviously, as I said, first biopsy didn't work out. He just didn't believe. Thank God he didn't settled with the first result. Like some doctor would say, hey, look, there is nothing there. So let's just monitor it and see what's going to happen. But he didn't settle. He did it himself. And after the second biopsy, the result was clear. And that's what his conclusion and conclusion of the board of the doctors he collected together, that we have to go ahead with the surgery.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting and also very lucky that they didn't say, you know what, let's just monitor it.
At the beginning, that's what they were, that's basically based on the CT scan and MRI, that's what they were saying. It's luckily, it's not going to spread. So if we can contain that thing inside and it's not going to do any harm to the body and organs, then we can just go with that. But yes.
Yeah, likely is the word that always gives me pause, is it might likely not spread, but let's try to get more of a guarantee. You are right. Made a huge difference in what your journey could have actually ended up looking like.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
My journey my journey probably would be finished by now. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, you're right. It very well could have been.
It could be.
You're absolutely right.
Well, I'm pretty sure it could be, because when they diagnosed me first, it was a first stage. I'm like, I'm so lucky. But by the time they did the surgery, because the prosthetic has to be printed in a special facility in East Coast, and it takes usually 6 weeks. So it's a month and a half. So by the time they diagnosed me, I did another MRI. They, based on that, they did a 3D scan and sent there, and it took 6 weeks there. They sent back another probably week until to make appointment. I was already on the stage two.
Yeah. Progressed very quickly.
Progressed
you know
quickly.
What I mean?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, something you bring up here is when we say time matters with a sarcoma diagnosis,
Absolutely.
It does matter, because you don't just say, okay, we're going to have surgery. There is a preparation. And in your case, you have to wait for this 3D hip to be printed and before you can even get to the surgery step. Time matters in that early diagnosis. And not just the early diagnosis, but the pressing for an actual diagnosis by your doctor really does make a difference and did make a difference for you.
Yes, every person is very unique. Every person is like a fingerprint, like we all different. And somebody may progress slower, and somebody may notice that problem much later than I did. I think that person might detect it later when it was already on the second stage or third stage.
And I think also what happens to people in sarcoma is they feel a pain, think it'll last a couple of days, it'll go away. I know it's bothering me, but it's not that bad, so I can wait. And then when you finally go, sometimes in sarcoma, when you go, they dismiss it. Right. Oh, the same thing you were thinking. Oh, it's just a pain. Physical therapy. Didn't they tell you just do some physical therapy?
Yep.
So that's what happens. Just do some physical therapy.
Yep.
And you should be fine. And I think that is a common journey.
Yeah. A lot of people, and even I know a bunch of those people that like, they don't want to go to doctor. They like, I have pain here and pain there, but I take some pills and I go on with my life. Right. But they don't pay attention to that. They don't think that might lead to something more serious. Mm-hmm. Just little pain. Yes, you're right.
You are very proactive in knowing your body and saying, this isn't right. I'm going to go to the doctor. And then when you were going through the physical therapy and trying to work that out, you knew this isn't working. It's not getting better. We need to do something else. And that is a real sign of self-advocacy, which we at SFA promote for patients to really speak up for yourself and ask for what you need.
Even before the surgery, in between me finishing physical therapy and going up to the point where my surgeon said, we're going for the surgery, it's in between those two events, it's countless appointments with the surgeon and doing MRI. And you have to wait 2, 3, 4 days for MRI to be sent to the office. And then you meet in the doctor and then he's asking for CT scan. And it's the same story. It's 4 or 5 days here or there. It's, oh, you look, it's already 4 months past. Yeah. Before they even said, okay, now we're certain about this problem and when we're going to operate. From that point on, you look in another like 6 to 7 weeks before they schedule surgery.
Right.
Yeah. And in between, you've had no treatment whatsoever.
No, because there's no treatment. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
There's no treatment. So when the doctor brought up the surgery to you, was it more, okay, you're going to have surgery? Or was it, you're going to have surgery and it's going to be really complex. Let me tell you about it.
Yes. We had a lot of conversation about it because I'm very active in my life, in my career. I definitely didn't want to lose that. I needed to be fully functional and return back to my active life. I understand the limitations it might have, certain in the gym and the physical activities, but overall, I wanted to return to normal life. And we discussed with the doctor a lot, and my surgeon was saying, as any surgeon, before any surgery would say that after you recover, it might be some complication, like limping or your nerve will be affected in your leg and you won't feel certain part of the leg or you will walk downstairs funny. And there's the things like that. And so I was expressing my desire, I would say, how I want to be after the surgery and that crucial for me to be, to completely recover and return back to my active life. And thank God my surgeon is, he's probably one of the rare specialists that like God gifted. And because chondrosarcoma doesn't get enough attention, he's digging, he's trying different approaches in the surgery. And that's what he did with me because a prior surgery, he did the traditional way. Some people didn't feel part of the leg. It was like affecting their walk and movements. With me, he went completely different way and he cut and separated everything the way he didn't affect nerves, cartilages, any tissues, and everything grow back. And I'm recovering. I'm still recovering, but it's when I will be 100%, I will be like I never had the surgery.
We were just talking about this morning.
I'm just going to say that.
The fact that you told them, this is what I want. This is how I would like the outcome to be. You pushed them to approach it and think about it differently so that you could get the outcome that was important to you. And that is that kind of conversation is so important to have with your medical professionals so that you're on the same page. Obviously, that's all they can do is the best they can. But the fact that they thought differently and approach it differently because you shared with them that was important to you is right. so important for people to hear that you can have those conversations with your medical yeah. professionals. And it's important to have those conversations.
Yeah, Brandy and I were literally just talking this morning about sharing your goals for your outcome with your care team so that you can right. work together on your treatment, because that may affect those goals, which route you go. And that way, if you're having these conversations, you're getting more information to help inform your decision and your care team's decision about the route they want to take with you. And like Brandy said, this is a great example of you sat down with your surgeon and said, hey, this is what I do for a career. I want to be able to do this. How can we try and make that happen? And you found a way forward together.
Yeah, you're right. I don't think any person in the world who goes through any type of surgery after the recovery want to be less of the person he was before.
Sure.
But not many people speak out. They just go there, and doctors, as I said, the surgeons always will prepare you for the worst. And then the surgeon said, oh, so we're going this way, and after the surgery, you might have this and that. But the people like, I believe my surgeon, so I'm going to go with that. No, you should paint the picture the way you want to be after you recover. Because I yeah. think, yeah, obviously, in any surgery, there is a traditional approach that surgeons know how to do. They've been doing it for years. But if you started to speak out and you will express how you want to be, you don't want to be, you don't want to do this, and you don't want this to happen to you. You want to be as the same as active person as you were before. I think that's what make surgeon to think.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah,
definitely.
You said that perfectly. You're absolutely right. So many people don't speak out, but they should. They
yes.
listen to the surgeon, and the surgeon says, this is what it's going to be. And they think they don't have a voice, and they don't think they can say, okay, but I would like something different. And they don't engage in the conversation or initiate the conversation, but they can and they should.
I would venture to say a medical professional appreciates that because it challenges them to think outside the box sometimes.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think that's how we grow in medicine sometimes.
Absolutely.
You have to think.
Yeah, exactly. That's how progress has been made for anything. Like, you have to speak out. You have to say, I don't want to have this and that. Can we achieve this? At least to have a conversation and ask right. the surgeon if it's possible after the surgery, after the recovery, for me to be this way.
So this surgery is a big surgery, and you have an active career and someone who performs stunts, and you're an active individual. First of all, how long was this surgery, and how did they prepare you for the recovery?
Surgery was gruesome. 9 hours, I was on the table. My surgeon and my plastic surgeon work in tandem. Both of them are just brilliant minds. Me and my wife, we went to the hospital before the surgery, preparation. I went through a lot of hardship in my life. So if that problem occurred, I'll just shut down myself and I'm going with it. So we went there. They took me to the preparation room. And while I was in preparation room, he came, talked to my wife multiple times. Then when I'm almost was ready to go to the surgery room, he came right before the surgery. He came and told my wife, we're going a different route.
Oh, wow.
He said before the surgery, he said to me, I was thinking about you and this surgery all night prior to that, how to do that. That's what he told me. But then right before the surgery, he came out, last time he came out to see my wife, he said, we're going different route. He said, we're gonna approach this differently. We're gonna cut everything inside differently. Before, it's supposed to be a scar like a Mercedes sign. He said, we're going completely different way, and we're going to cut the way it's going to be like a question mark. And because that way, he said, we can go around nerves, connective tissues, we can cut the muscles the way it's less harmful that with a Mercedes sign approach. And I didn't know anything of that. He told my wife, and I went to the surgery. It was 9 hours, got back. And when I woke up, I couldn't move. I didn't have any, not like energy, I didn't have any strength even to lift my arm. It was many complications. During the 16 days, I was in the hospital, like a week in ICU and then in a trauma ICU, and then like just a little bit over a week in not a regular room. What they explained to me is like in between ICU and the regular hospital. And then that's they kept me there for about a little bit more than a week. And there was a complication with my stomach, which is happens with any patient that been in a freezing room for that long period of time. I think it calls ileus. It's like your stomach, because you in the like a very cold room for such a long period of time,
like the OR.
Your stomach freezes and it doesn't work. And it's like the internal gas doesn't come out. So it stays inside because stomach, your organs don't work, your intestinal, your stomach, they don't work. And it stays inside. And my stomach was like getting like a balloon.
Oh, yeah.
And they don't want to do anything to you to relieve it because they want to wait for your body to start to work. Because that's the best way to get out of it. I had that for about 5 days. I was like a 9-month pregnant woman.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was like, so I don't know how I went through this, to be honest, psychologically.
It was very painful. Was it
yes,
very
absolutely. Because it's a balloon when you pump the air inside. It's every day it's getting bigger and bigger.
Right. And you mentioned, I'm sure it's hard to go through something psychologically that you're not anticipating on top of the surgery itself, because you're anticipating recovering from this major surgery on your hip, but you're not anticipating a complication with your stomach that is painful and surprising. So to have to then think, oh my gosh, this on top of it, now I'm in pain here.
But there's another problem on top of it, because your stomach doesn't work. The fluid inside, it doesn't go out. So they have to put a tube through my nose into my stomach to pump out that it was like a black liquid.
Oh, gosh.
That was all the waste that was like collecting inside. It has to be pumped out. So for 5 days, I was with that tube that goes through my nose. It's like crazy uncomfortable and the stomach. So 5 days. And finally, after 5 days, when it got resolved, was like, I'd probably never been happy in my life.
I'm sure. You said something that's interesting. You said, I don't know how I got through that mentally. And I think people hear these kinds of stories and think, oh, I could never. And I always say to people, you don't have a choice. And when you're in it, you just find a way. So how do you think you found that way to go through that?
As I said before, I went through many hardships in my life. And my body, I guess at a very early life when I started to face hardships, I was training myself to go through that. But with the time, my body got that ability, training, get used to it, that like in the situations like this, I just shut down and I just go through that. I just go.
Tunnel vision.
Yes, it doesn't matter how hard it is, how painful, I just go through that. And obviously, huge thing of me going through all of this and coming out, it's because of my wife. She was with me for 16 days in that hospital. She slept on the little couch there, and she was there basically 21, 22 hours out of 24 every day. She had two and a half hours, got back, get something to eat, collect some stuff for the next day and go. During the day when I was sleeping, she wasn't sleeping. At night when I was sleeping, she was laying there with one eye open to if I need anything or if nurse didn't come at the time. She was advocating for me. She was fighting for me.
That support is so important. And we have conversations all the time at SFA about the care partner and how they are so much a part of the journey, that the patient can't do it without the care partners and how much support they need too going through this. You're not going through it alone. Your wife is going through it with you and being that person for you. So that's something we're very focused on, is making sure that the care partner feels supported too and equally informed. I'm thinking as you're talking about her, that moment that the surgeon comes out right before they start your surgery saying, hey, we're going a different route. In my head, I was thinking that's like a Grey's Anatomy curveball. Derek Shepherd's up all night thinking about this surgery. I'm like, here's the real life.
You're watching this TV show. You're watching this TV show, so you don't think, in real life, it would never happen like this.
Right, and here it is.
You know?
Yes.
Right? They're running me into the surgery unit, and he's coming out. And he's, okay, we're going different route. We're doing different approach to that.
Brandy knows I'm a big Grey's Anatomy fan. I'm thinking of Derek Shepherd with the tumor on the wall, thinking about it all night, drawing out all the different routes and carving it out. So he comes out and says to your wife, here, we're going another route. And she then has to be the one to be your voice while you're back on the table. Yep. And it's equally as important as the patient being informed is the person who's caring for them feeling supported as well, so that they can be there for that person.
And make that decision.
Yeah. Did all legal papers and everything before, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, sign off.
I sign off my life. She's now can do anything. If she want to go to my bank and withdraw the money from my account, she can.
You know? Oh, my gosh. Oh, wow.
It's funny.
It's really such an intense surgery.
I just want to be very clear about, you mentioned they also replaced your hips, but it wasn't just a hip replacement.
No.
So can you talk a little bit about exactly what they did? Because I know that I have heard the term bionic man that people have referred to you as. So can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. Designed the same part, the same pelvis from titanium. And they basically, when they cut it, the titanium half, they put it together, and they, with the big screws, they screw it into the bone pelvis. And then, obviously, the hip replacement, and it's all tied together. But, yeah, I have the pictures somewhere that really, the picture of the how they did it. That X-ray picture where, like, you can see all these multiple screws going through pelvis and the hip replacement. You can see everything there.
Wow. So they really had to piece it back together like a puzzle.
Yeah. Basically, what they did from 3D printing, they did this titanium part. It's exactly the same as a bone part. And they have to just put them together and screw through. That's it.
Make them fit.
That's incredible.
It's amazing because it's not just one size fits all.
Right.
They have that titanium prosthetic part and they just like shove into you, no matter you're like 6 feet tall or you're like 5'2", it just goes there. It's a custom made. It's like they have to go through all this process, MRI, then 3D printing from the plastic. Then that part goes into facility and they receive that part and they already design and put together and whatever the mold or whatever they do from titanium.
It's amazing that can be done. Like when you think about 3D printing and building something custom, usually you would think they need the model, right? Like a real model they can hold in their hands and model it, but they couldn't. So they had to just use their pictures. And it has to fit because it's not like we can send it back and fix it and then come back. We've got one shot at this.
I guess, you know, that whatever they're using, the process, the machines that they're using and stuff, it's so like precise and it can obviously like they can 3D printed from MRI images.
Yeah, it's amazing.
That's amazing because it's like a piece of paper, basically. Right. And the computer can read it and add volume to that and print it that way.
It's like Grey's Anatomy.
it is fascinating. Actually, my physiotherapist, who I'm working with now, I think he's 96 years old. And he did the same procedure, but it was like 20 years ago.
Oh,
wow.
He doesn't have that. What they did, they cut half of his pelvis and he put the rod there. They put the rod there, metal rod. And let's say this is two hips, right? From the waist down, hips and the legs. He doesn't have that normal natural curve. He got dent.
Oh, interesting.
In his hip. The engineering wasn't there. Like 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, they couldn't do it because they didn't have the technology.
And on top of it, his leg is, I think, like he said, 5 or 6 inches shorter.
Wow.
So he has to wear the...
Like platform. An elevated,
yeah,
elevated platform shoe, yeah.
But it tells you how... And my surgeon said, if you went through this surgery 10, 12 years ago, you wouldn't be the same. I never thought before about engineering, about those people working on developed better and more quality product for human being to move freely, like that the joint never was removed. It's still there, but it's like titanium. I never thought about it before. And now I started to think after this surgery, I started to think how much effort and money and research put into, forget about medical aspect of it, just the engineering. People who work solely on these prosthetics, it's crazy to me.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
I was going to say it really highlights the importance of the research, like you said, not just the medical research, which equally you're talking about having a chondrosarcoma where there isn't a lot of known. There's still so much to learn. So that's important. But then equally important is the prosthetic research and the engineering.
Absolutely.
And it really highlights how much time and energy and resources goes into it and how much funding is needed for these things to bring people an outcome like yours. As time goes on, like you said, 10 years ago, this wouldn't be your outcome. And if we want even better outcomes in the next 10 years, we have to continuously be investing in this research and these advancements.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because with, let's say, different type of cancer, if we talk in financial aspect, right, mm-hmm. their money goes into the research how to heal the cancer and to improve chemotherapy, right? Mm-hmm. There were all these cocktails. But in this case, because some of chondrosarcoma, they can be treated by chemotherapy. So in this, if it just any cancer has two branches, right? This chemotherapy cocktail and research how to kill the cancer, the chondrosarcoma has like basically three branches. Mm-hmm. Also chemotherapy, also how to not to kill the cancer, but how to eliminate the cancer, the different approaches in the surgery. And the third branch is prosthetics.
Prosthetic.
Yeah.
In my head, it's a bigger cancer.
Yeah, because we talk about this with sarcomas in general. It can be not even just a chondro subtype. It can be other subtypes. We've had other guests on here that also had to have prosthetics. Because as far as we've come in medicine, in sarcoma, even an amputation is a real thing. Yeah. And sometimes that's the only option people have. And so they also are very reliant on the prosthetic. And we've had conversations even on this podcast about the duality of being a cancer patient, but also in the prosthetic world. So it is real interesting because prosthetics can become very much a part of the journey. And
yes,
maybe the ultimate end option that you have.
Yes, and you're right. I actually didn't think about it now, but yes, it's not only prosthetics that goes into your body, but it's also if for amputee, they have a different type of prosthetics to be functional, Because right, prosthetic right. goes into your body, it will be functional because it's surrounded by muscles and connective right. tissue. So you have developed those muscles back again for your prosthetic inside to work, but it's up to your body. But therefore, amputee, that prosthetic has to be robotic for you to function in real life, for that prosthetic to move and grab the cup or whatever, like the, for you to feel like you, okay, I can do what I've done before.
As a matter of fact, we had a guest for this podcast that a law enforcement officer, and they had to amputate his foot. And it was a whole journey of his prosthetic so he could go back to work as a law enforcement officer doing exactly what he did before. Getting the amputation was the best thing for him because his prosthetic is amazing and he's back out as a law enforcement officer in Chicago. So yeah, prosthetics are a very important part of the sarcoma journey. You're right, whether they're inside or outside. Where are you now in your recovery phase?
I'm still working with my therapist. He comes one or twice a week. I'm working with them. What my surgeon and my physiotherapist told me, I'm about 2 months ahead of the regular person good to going through the surgery. I'm actually the first patient, I guess, in the history of this illness who stood the second day after the surgery. My surgeon said he's like a first patient in the country, like in this field, that could stand after the second day after the surgery. I started to work out with the physiotherapist right in the hospital. They come like a few times and it was like really hard. You don't feel your leg at all. But as I said, I'm 2 months ahead of everybody and I'm working with one crutch already. I can do without any assistant, I can do maybe 5 steps, 4 or 5 steps back. My muscles are coming back. It's still there work to be done because I'm a little bit limping on the operated leg, but it's everything is the same length. It seems to me like this leg is a little bit shorter because of the muscles.
Oh,
I'm compensating still with the left side. And when the muscles will get back completely, get back to the shape they were before, to the condition they were before, then everything will be shifted to, yeah.
Yeah, that's a big part of rehabbing, I feel, is not only regaining function, but then correcting for the compensation that's happening while you're doing that.
For me, it's probably the more complicated part, correcting it, because working with the program he gives me for mobility and strength, there is no problem for me to go through this. But that correction of the leveling both legs, that's what the hardest.
Right. Your healthy side has almost like gained skills to compensate for the other side. And then you have to teach it to stop overtaking to then get that other side to regain the skills the other side has compensated for. Yeah, it's very interesting. I teach Pilates and this is very...
Bring that up, Natasha.
I'm thinking here, I'm like, oh, the pelvis. Like, I know so much about the pelvis. How is your mobility in the pelvic area?
It's fine. Yeah. I like when I do exercises for pelvic moving in and out.
Yeah.
Before, when I started, I could feel that part moving inside. Now I practically don't. It's just like very small echo somewhere in a dark corner over there. But it's, I think, in probably 3 weeks or a month, I won't feel it at all.
Yeah, it's all very fascinating because the pelvis, the legs, the abdomen, everything is connected. So if you remove half your pelvis and replace it, your entire body has to relearn and adjust to that.
Yep. If you think it's 1/4 of your body got replaced, you divide the person this way and this way. This is like a hip and leg. They just, let's replace that part. And you like a baby, right? Newborn baby, you have to learn to walk again. This part doesn't understand how to do that.
Yeah, it's a very fascinating element of just the human condition, though, that you can go through that and have 1/4 of your body removed and replaced and regain function is pretty miraculous. It's very scientific, but it's also pretty miraculous.
Yep.
So when you were first diagnosed with sarcoma, I imagine you never heard of it before. I think you found someone in the UK that had your same surgery.
My wife found this guy. He's a semi-pro basketball player. So he's also active and in sports and stuff like that. And he also wanted to live fully active life after the surgery. So he had not chondrosarcoma, but chondroblastoma. It's like non-cancerous tissue, but still it's still affecting your body. And you still he had to still go through the surgery.
Right.
And his surgery was done in traditional way. And he went through also many problems after that. But he recovered and he's completely active now. He does this Iron Man thing, and like he just recently went to, I don't remember what mountain he climbed, but like he climbed some mountain. So he's back to hiking every day, long distances, like 20 miles a day, something like that. So he's completely back to normal life. But he shared his journey, and she was talking to him and she was asking him different questions about different stages of recovery, and he shared that experience, how it was with him and what better to do, what better not to do. And yeah, that was helpful. That was helpful in it also on the level that there is no communities with chondrosarcoma.
Yeah.
Like I'm sure like any other cancers, there's probably like a millions of those groups. You can go and people share experience. It's hard to gauge, especially, I've never heard about it before. Oh, it's one person out of 200,000. It's that rare. So what's going to happen? How you deal with that?
That's a big motivating factor in starting this podcast, is how often we hear from people saying that their diagnosis is isolating. They've never heard of somebody else having what they have, and wanting to hear from people and those personal stories that you're not alone. And there are other people out there who exist with and have gone through challenges that you're going through now. And I think that makes a big difference in the patient journey of just knowing you're not going through this alone, even if it feels like you are the only person in the world going through this.
Absolutely. And for your confidence as well, you basically, you're dealing with something you never even heard before.
Yep.
You've heard about different type of cancers, and you heard from people saying about those cancers, how like their friends recover, or how the people they know, they recovered. So you have certain picture how it go. But there is like when you hear about something that you never heard before, and you're thinking like, how I'm going to deal with this?
Yeah.
There is no information out there.
Mm-hmm. It sounds to me from hearing you talk and just from what I know from our engagement before coming up to this podcast recording is the role that your wife played. I know we talked about her being in the hospital, being that advocate and being the caregiver, but it sounds like she was an amazing advocate throughout the entire journey, looking for information and being a part of the entire journey with you, and which allowed you to focus on the recovery. And she is going to help talk to the medical professionals and have someone that you can make decisions with and have a conversation with. And it sounds like she has been a real fierce advocate for you and for your journey.
Absolutely. Yes. She made everything stress-free for me. You're facing a lot of stress when you wake up after the surgery. Or I will do this, or how I will do that, or how I'll go to the bathroom, or how will, you know, it's overwhelming. Suddenly simple things that you never thought through your entire life becoming like, wow, how I'm going to do this? Like
right.
This in my situation now, this is like almost impossible. So she did everything for me to be stress-free and just focus on my recovery.
And in the field that you're in, being an actor and all, I can imagine that a diagnosis like this makes your future very uncertain. In terms of what will my acting career continue to look like?
like people I know, people I'm close to, I let them know in advance that I'm going to go through the surgery and what's going to happen. And they will be very long recovery because I knew recovery is going to be about a year. So they knew, those people supported me and through all my journey, the after the surgery and when I got released from the hospital, and still now. With the industry, you don't announce anything. I just, at the point where I am right now, I'm obviously like, I don't do any auditions right now because what's the point? I will take as long as I need to recover. And after that, I will go back and I will do what I've done before. It's beauty of this industry is it's not 9 to 5, so you don't have to, right. Nobody's going to fire you. It's you don't have to report to boss and say, I cannot function next year. Sorry, replace me with somebody and then I come back. So that's the beauty of this business. But yeah, I'm just focused on recovering. And as soon as I recover, I will get back to what
figure it out from there.
Yeah.
And maybe who knows what the future holds, that you're going through this journey, you're focused on the present and figuring out the present, and you'll take things as they come.
Yep. Yep. That's what I will do. I'm at the stage where I'm like only focused on my recovery, you know, and it slowed down as any process. At the beginning, it was fast. After you released, after the hospital and started to work with the physiotherapist, it's, just say progress every day. And it's significant for the maybe like couple of months. And then it slowed down and you're like, it's going to take longer. I want to be fully functioned right now. But it is what it is. It's a process and process takes time. And so just focus on this right now and try not to think anything else.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, that's a good way to approach it.
I will ask our last questions then. We always end with two questions that are always similar in every podcast. So the first one is, if you could tell our listeners anything, one message, what would your message be to them?
I would say appreciate your life, appreciate your health, be appreciative to what you have, your health and your life.
That's a good one. And then other question, if listeners wanted to connect with you, they wanted to follow along on your journey, where can they find you?
I have Instagram at the Andrei Ivchenko. I have Threads also at Andrei Ivchenko. And I have Facebook at Andrei Ivchenko without that V.
Amazing. We will link it all. Yeah, we'll link it all in the notes to make it easy for everybody.
Yeah. And they can go play Call of Duty and hear this iconic voice.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
They can go watch Stranger Things.
Stranger Things.
That's right.
Seeing the Virgin.
Right. Yes. Lucifer.
And the whole list.
Yeah.
The whole list.
Yeah. And check out the IMBD.
Yes. Whatever you want to do.
And by the time this releases, they can also come to the Stand Up to Sarcoma Gala.
Exactly.
One of our honorees there this year, which is that's amazing. Right.
Yes, absolutely. Bring the people with money.
That's right. If there's one thing we heard through this discussion is, we need more investment for sure in research, and we need more awareness, 100%.
Andrei, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story and speaking to that need for more awareness and more research.
You guys, appreciate it. See you at the gala.
SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners. To amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients, SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatments and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link.
Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.